All right, I think this, yes, we're on. We are good to go. We are going to hopefully finish up our discussion of the birth narratives in the Gospels this morning. I don't know how well that will go, how quickly or well or rapidly that will go. We could go over one more Sunday, but I hope not. We're going to look at the wise men today, and maybe then also, if we have time, get to the genealogies. But if we finish the wise men, I'm not going to push the genealogies. Maybe we'll be about 10 of the time. We'll look at that some other, maybe next Advent we can look at the genealogies in Luke and Matthew. But I want to focus on the wise men today. Terry, would you pray for us?
Sure. Again, Heavenly Father, we thank you for this Christian at our town, for us adults, for the youth and the children. Be with us as we continue our Christmas study on your birth and the different individuals that came to visit you at your birth.
Amen. Thank you. So the story of the visitation of the Magi is found in chapter 2 of Matthew, chapter 2. And I'll read it for us, and then we'll dive in here. Now, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word, that I too may come and worship him.' After listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, and going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh, and being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way." Let me just read that next section too. We might get to it. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother and flee to Egypt and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, "Out of Egypt I called my son." Okay, so we started talking about this last week a little bit, and we introduced the Magi, who they are, what that is, what a Magi is. We get the word magician from that in English, and sometimes they're called wise men. Basically, who they were Eastern astrologers, and we said that the reason they would be headed to Jerusalem is that perhaps they were familiar with Israelite prophecy, the Jewish prophecy, and how would people from the East be familiar with prophecy found in the Old Testament? What did we say? Remember?
Daniel,
right. Daniel, when the captives, when Babylon, the Babylonians defeated Israel and took Jerusalem and destroyed the temple, they also took captives to Babylonia. And there in Babylon, Daniel and some Jewish men maintained their faith, and they rose to high places in the government, and they would have passed on to the other to the wise men in Nebuchadnezzar and the other emperor's courts, the knowledge that they had about what God had revealed to them in the Old Testament. And we know that there was a class of men who were called Magi existing at the time that Daniel and and Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and all the others were in Babylon. And it, even by Jesus' day, there was still a kind of recognized class of very well-trained, very well-educated, we would probably call them astrologers, but let's just say scholar astrologer. They were very important men. Sometimes they would find themselves in the employment of kings in various places, and they would sometimes be sent as ambassadors to other kingdoms, other places. We have records, in fact, of some of them being sent when one of the kings of Parthia had a son. Another king in that area sent some wise men to offer gifts and to celebrate the birth. Be their ambassador. So this is what we read in Matthew wasn't uncommon, isn't something strange. What's uncommon about it is what evoked the travel, what evoked the journey of these wise men to Jerusalem, and that's the appearance of this star. Notice what they say in verse 2. Where is he who has been born King of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose, and have come to worship him. And all kinds of debate and discussion and argument surrounds the identification of this star. What is it? There are some people who say, well, it must be some kind of astronomical event that caused these magi to come to Jerusalem. There are others who say, no, because let's notice the behavior of this particular star. Back down in verse 9, after listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went on before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. The star apparently led them not just to Bethlehem, but to the place where Jesus was with his parents. The star moved and stopped. So others would say, well, it can't be an actual star. Maybe it's a comet. Maybe it's some kind of once in a blue moon asteroid, something along those lines. And so there's lots of debate about what exactly they saw. Before answering that question, though, I think we should maybe go back and see and look at one prophecy that might explain why they might be looking to the sky to find when a king of Israel might come. And for that, we want to turn to Numbers. Chapter 24, I believe. Let me get to it. Numbers chapter 24. Now, Numbers, how many here have read through the book of Numbers? I warn you, if you try to read the book of Numbers, the first two chapters are okay, but then you're going to get bogged down because a lot of it is, okay, and then this tribe offered this offering, and this tribe offered that offering, and this tribe offered this offering, and if you number all the tribes, how many there are, here's what. So it can be tiresome to read, but it's worth it if you dig into the details there. All God's word is worth reading. But when we come to chapter 24, we run into the story of Balaam. Who remembers who Balaam is?
Prophet that was hired by a foreign nation to curse the Israelites.
Yes, King Barak. I hope that beats out where Obama got his name from. But King Barak saw this great horde of people coming up from Egypt, and he was worried. He was a Moabite, and he worried about letting these people pass through his land, or even if they were to pass through his land, wherever they settle, they're going to be a threat. So he knows of this seer named Balaam, who is kind of greasy, put it that way. He's the kind of guy you could probably pay to say what you want. And you know, in those days, it's very interesting. And there's a parallel in our day. It was believed that your words have power. I mean, you might wonder, why would you, because this king is going to hire Balaam to come and curse Israel. And you might think, well, what would that do if I just pay somebody to say bad words over an army? What good would that be? Well, they believed that words have power, and that if Balaam would just speak curses over Israel, that would actually bring about some kind of negative destiny for them. Does that sound familiar to anybody? Because that's exactly what many in what's called the Word of Faith movement believe today. That if you just speak positively over your circumstances and make positive decrees that, hey, everything's going to come up roses because your words have power. And then when they don't come up roses, guess what? Guess whose fault that is? It's yours, because you didn't have enough faith in the words that you spoke. But it also works negatively. So you'll read books. Who listens to Joyce Myers here? I hope you don't ever listen to Joyce Myers. But Joyce Myers says, you know, it works negatively too, so that if you speak negatively about your circumstances, so you say, hey, I feel like I'm getting sick, or hey, man, I'm worried I'm going to lose out on this deal that I'm involved in. Don't say that, because that's putting negative words over your situation, and those have power, and you're going to curse yourself. So, that's a belief held within many, many, many pretty prominent evangelical churches nowadays. And it's false. It's a lie. That's pagan. That's what Balaam is believing, and the king who hires him. That's what they're entrusting themselves to. So anyway, that was kind of an aside. But the king sends emissaries to this Balaam, who's a seer, saying, hey, we'll pay you. You come curse these guys. Balaam acts very holy. He's probably trying to get more money out of him. And he says, well, I don't know. I can only say what God gives me to say. And so he sleeps on it, and God says, go with him. And do as they say. And so he goes, but apparently God sees that on the way that Balaam's still trying to get cash out of the deal, and so he stops him. This is where Balaam's riding his donkey along the road, and his donkey stops, and he starts beating his donkey, and then his donkey turns around and says, hey, stop. And because he's stopped because an angel stood before him on the road. And if he had kept going, both the donkey and Balaam would be killed. And the whole point of that was to provide warning for Balaam. You're going to do, when you get there, exactly what I say to do. So you know that they find up, and he comes to Balak. It's Balak. It's not. I keep getting the name wrong. He finds his way to Balak, and Balak shows him the people of Israel from a mountainside, and he says, hey, I want you to curse these guys. And he opens his mouth, and instead of curses, blessings come out. And no matter what Balak gets mad, he tries to take him to another area to look at another part of the army, to see from another part of the people, so he's going to look over here, you'll curse them. No, and he tries to, opens his mouth, and then comes out blessings instead of curses. Now, as part of one of these blessings, there is a blessing that pertains to this particular, let me find it here, to this particular moment in Israel's history. It's kind of a prophecy. There it is in verse, this is right there in verse 15. And he took up his discourse. This is chapter 24 of Numbers. He took up his discourse and said, the oracle of Balaam, son of Beor, the oracle of the man whose eye is opened, the oracle of him who hears the words of God and who knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty falling down with his eyes uncovered. I see him now. I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab, and shall break all the sons of Seth. Edom shall be dispossessed. Israel is doing valiantly, and the one from Jacob shall exercise dominion and destroy the survivors of cities. So this is an image of a scepter, king, rising up out of Israel, who will rule the nations, who will destroy and conquer. the nations. Most Jews, especially by the time the Babylonians had invaded and destroyed Jerusalem, understood that to be a messianic prophecy, a prophecy looked forward to the Messiah. And so Daniel and Shadrach and Meshach and Abednego would have certainly shown this particular prophecy to Magi in Babylon. And so they would be perhaps looking toward the stars for some indication that this king might be coming. So let's turn back to Matthew chapter 2. That doesn't help us with the astronomical question, but it certainly helps us with why they might be looking at the sky. Okay, there's some prophetic word that would indicate they should be looking upwards in order to see the sign of the coming of this person, of this king. All right, so let me just run through some of the ideas here. One of them is this. About this time, in 7 B.C., what year was Jesus born?
6 B.C.
Was it 180? Yeah, we don't know exactly when he was born. Some say it's around 6 B.C. or 7 B.C. And we could get into how that happens. It would be very boring how we date that. It would be very boring. You'd all fall asleep. I don't want to do that. But some say around 7 B.C. And it just so happens that around 7 B.C., Jupiter and Saturn are in conjunction around Pisces, the constellation Pisces. Jupiter represents, for Eastern astrologers, the king, the great king of all the universe, the high king of kings. Saturn, for them, represents Israel. For many years had assigned Saturn to be the planet, or they would consider the star, that represents the Westerners. And they associated that with the area of Palestine. Those two planets were in conjunction. King of Kings from the West, right, in 7 BC. And they were in conjunction within this constellation Pisces, which for them also represented the end of times, the coming about of some kind of great cataclysm that would result in the end of history or the climax of history, something along those lines. And so, 7 BC, this is one thing, I'm not saying this is the way it is, this is a theory. 7 BC, these guys look up in the sky, they see Jupiter and Saturn in together in the constellation Pisces. They say, oh, well, that means that this king prophesied in the Old Testament, the Jewish Old Testament, must be born. He's going to be the one who crushes nations. Let's send him our envoys. Let's get in on his good side. And so these wise men head west. And what would be the natural place you would go if you're looking for a king born from the people of Israel, Where would you go?
Jerusalem.
Right. You wouldn't think I'm going to Bethlehem. You think I'm going to Jerusalem. That's where the king is. King Herod is. They may have even reasoned. They're pretty well known, pretty well connected. They probably would know who Herod is. Maybe they would have reasoned that Herod had a son. Herod must have had a boy. And so let's go and give him honor and give him these gifts. So they head over to Jerusalem. Now, what do you think about this theory? Just any.
It's possible, or literally, a star moved across the sky that the wise men followed.
Let's get some other. Okay, yes. Thank you. That's another theory.
I guess what I'd look for, if that was the theory I was going for, is other people could see the sky. So they must have also been. I mean, other people studied the stars who didn't necessarily also follow that prophecy.
Right.
And they would have theories about what's happening celestially. So
yes.
I'd look for other evidence, I guess.
But she's right. I mean, that Saturn and Jupiter were together in Pisces would have meant lots of things to lots of different people. I guess you might say, yes, but it just so happened that these people had been the ones that God sent Daniel and the exiles to. But regardless, and I think the biggest problem with this theory is the movement of the star, right? Neither Jupiter nor Saturn or Pisces guide you in a way that would lead you to a house where a baby is. They wouldn't stop over a house where a baby is. So there's two other theories that come from that idea. One is that this really happened to get these guys to Jerusalem. But then after they got to Jerusalem and Herod called his little council of the scribes, and the scribes said, hey, you know, Jesus was born in Bethlehem. Then as they were leaving toward Bethlehem, then there was another appearance, not in the same constellation, but in an actual supernatural kind of light in the sky that guided them to the very house where Mary and Joseph were with Jesus. That's one theory. Another one is that all along it was a supernatural kind of light, not just in the constellation, but even when they were in the east and first saw it, it was a supernatural kind of light in the west from their perspective that drew them to Jerusalem to see if they could find this king. So I don't care which one you happen to love, although I think it's really difficult to go with this one all the way through, because stars and planets don't behave the way the Bible indicates they do. I think there's some supernatural element here. God really did bring these guys in some way to the sun. Okay, so any questions about that? All right, let's keep going. Let's look at what happens when he gets to Herod. So when Herod, the king, heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Why do you think he was troubled?
He's the king himself.
I'm the king of the Jews. Right? Born the king of the Jews. I'm the king of the Jews. I actually killed my son, so there's no one else who's going to take my throne. He made a point of killing any challengers to his throne. He didn't even appoint an heir. In fact, King Herod the Great was an awful, awful guy. In his will, he dictated that all of his relatives and all of the people who were in prison, everyone in Israel who was in prison would be executed on the day of his death. And you know why? Because he knew no one would mourn over his passing, but he wanted to make sure the people mourned. And so he would kill as many people as possible when he died, so there would be some weeping in Jerusalem at his death. Like, he was a hard and cold and cruel, cruel guy. Not a pleasant man, but he's troubled because, wait a minute, these are scholars, astrologers, they've seen a star in the east which indicates there's a king to be born. That means that's a threat to my power. This also might strike you as odd let's say that Herod recognized that as a threat, but I mean, surely he would know that if this all is true, then the person he's fighting against is God. So it's not, if God's going to bring about the birth of a king, why would Herod want to go and try and thwart him? Wouldn't that be counterproductive? Especially seeing as how about this time he's really bad health. He's got about a year or two left in his life, and he's going to die soon. And so generally you would think that maybe you've been a jerk all your life, but when you get to be about 85 or 90 and you're sick, and you're not getting any better, you might then decide, you know what, I think I'm gonna put away all that other stuff and try to make myself right with God. But that's sometimes not the way that people thought in those days. Often people thought of themselves, especially people in power, would think of themselves, even people like Herod, who's in a Jewish context, would think of themselves as a kind of equal to God's. I have authority, I have power, right? Yes, look like Pharaoh. If you study the Exodus account, Pharaoh, the reason Pharaoh is so offended at Moses coming to him to say, the God of Israel says you should let my people go, is that the God of Israel to Pharaoh is a slave God. This is the God of slaves. I'm Pharaoh. I'm God. Pharaoh considered himself the personification of the God of Egypt. So why should he listen to the slave God who tells him, no. And so when God starts destroying Egypt for these these plagues, Pharaoh continues to just, I can't, no way I'm going to let this low class God take authority over me. And so he ruins himself because of his pride. Maybe the same kind of reasoning is going on here. We're not giving Herod's spiritual life much about what's going on in his head. We just know he's a wicked guy. Maybe the same kind of thing is going on here. We can't say that in general the human heart is like that, isn't it? The human heart, the reason we are in trouble as a race is because each and every one of us wants to be our own little God, and we will brook no challengers to the claim. So we don't like it when we're faced with the claims of Jesus, who says, I'm your God and I'm your king, and unless he works in our hearts, we won't submit to him. That's just kind of the human nature. So that same kind of thing is going on here. So Herod the king hears this. Oh, any questions, any thoughts at this point? Herod the king heard this. He was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. All Jerusalem, not just Herod. That's interesting too, because you would think that Jerusalem would be, maybe God is doing something. But that tells us something of the way these wise men would have been received by the average or the faithful Jew. How do you and I think of astrologers? Do you read your astrology section in the paper in the morning? I hope you don't. Not anymore. Okay, good. Yeah, I mean, it's so general, you know. Like, today's going to be a good day because good things are going to happen to you. Oh wow, good thing happened to me. It must be true. They're so general. Don't look to those things for guidance. And even when you do find guidance in things like that, when you go to maybe a personal astrologer and they read your stars and they tell you all about yourself, or you pick up, I think I told you the story, before I was a Christian, I picked up a book on Libras, because I'm a Libra. And I read that book and thought, man, that's exactly like who I am. This is describing me perfectly, and this is my personality. And so there's some, you know, there's sometimes you can see in these little things, there's little elements of truth. They seem to nail it. But the scriptures tell us why sometimes these things nail it. These things like tarot cards, like astrology, like mind readers or palm readers. Satan uses them. Demons use them to seek and draw you away from the truth, the Bible. The demons would much rather have you looking to Madame Bovary and her palm reading than the Bible for instruction in life. And so they're gonna use these little things to lure you away from God. Yes?
I just have a thought I have to tell you. I much prefer the gypsy card reading.
You to what? To what? What do you prefer prefer the gypsy card?
Yeah. Because I'm a poker player.
Oh, to the newspaper. Yeah. Not to the Bible.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Well, I would suggest they're probably when you go to the gypsy card readers, they're going to be more accurate than the astrologer. But again, that's because they're accessing information from the demonic realm. So you're hearing stuff that's going to try and draw you away from Jesus. Yes.
What do you say to someone who takes part in palm readings? Like, my boss had someone come to her house and read people's palms. It was like, everything's coming through. I don't know what to say.
The demons know stuff.
That's
the first problem.
Right?
So you might just say, yeah, demons know stuff. Demons are smarter than we are. They see more than we do. They know a lot about, they're not omniscient, but they know a lot more about you than you know about you, because they're good studying the character. They know what turns you on. They know what makes you tick. They know what you like. They know your past. And so, again, you go to a card reader or whatever, or someone looking at your crystal ball, and just, oh, you had an uncle named Ned, didn't you? Yeah, I did have an uncle named Ned. Oh, I see him right now. He's sitting in his old leather chair and he's watching the football game on TV. And he says, oh, Ned always used to sit in his old leather chair and watch football on TV. You must be in touch with Uncle Ned. No, he's in touch with a demon. Demons see Uncle Ned. So Uncle Ned do all the stuff that Uncle Ned did. So yeah, right, he knows. That's how demons lead you away from Jesus. They get you hooked on some other source of knowledge and revelation apart from Jesus Christ and the scriptures.
I think this year, I've heard the Christmas story so many times coming up, but what happened in, Matthew 2, 4 and 5, that the Jews and the religious leaders missed it totally.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just a reminder, head knowledge is not the same as an experience with Jesus Christ.
That's a great point. The scribes had the right knowledge about where Christ would be born.
That's true.
But I think I could see, having a discussion about astrologers, why they might be loath to listen to astrologers, right? Because they're thinking, these are pagans. These are people who worship false gods. Right? Why would we listen to what they have to say about the God of Israel? Now, they have come, though. They could have said, well, look, we're just following your scriptures. The reason we're here is because your Bible says something about the star rising over Jacob, and we think we saw that star. So can you just tell us where this king might be born? We don't have to worship our gods. Just let us know. And that, you're right, that might have at least sparked some curiosity, but I think the animosity on the part of the people of Jerusalem is because of who these guys were. They're pagans. They're not going to listen to him. And so there's Herod in the verse 4 assembling all the chief priests and the scribes of the people. He inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. And that's very clear. The Bible tells us, told them where the Christ was to be born. And the city of David, the place where David was born and was raised. The place where, it goes all the way back. I mean, when Rahab the prostitute became a believer in Yahweh, she married Solomon. Yeah, and then who was their baby? Do you know who their baby was? Their baby was Boaz. And Boaz married Ruth from Moabite. Yeah, Moabitess, right? And then Ruth and Boaz had Obed, and then Obed had Jesse, and then Jesse had David. That's the city of David. That's where the king comes from. So Micah chapter 5 says, one day, Bethlehem, even though you're small, you're going to be the place where the Messiah comes. In fact, you see the prophecy right there in verse 6 quoted. And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people. Now, it's interesting, if you take this quote, keep your finger there, and go back to Micah chapter 5. Micah is in the minor prophets, so there's 12 of those guys. So if you just go to Matthew, take a left, and you'll hit Malachi, and then somewhere between Malachi and Dan. If you hit Dan, you've gone too far. You're going to find Micah. And Micah chapter 5 is beginning chapter 1, verse 1. Where is it? Make sure I have it. Am I in the wrong place myself?
Micah 5, 2.
There we are. Okay, yes. Okay, but Micah 5, chapter 2, or chapter 5, verse 2. Let's just start at the beginning, verse 1. Now muster your troops, O daughter of troops. Siege is laid against us. With a rod they strike the judge of Israel on the cheek. But you, O Bethlehem, Ephrathah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from of old, from ancient of days. Now, we've talked about this Micah prophecy before. That from of old, from ancient of days, is an interesting way of speaking, because the coming forth refers to birth. And I don't know about you, but my children, when they came forth, they didn't come from old age. They from ages old. They came from, like, you know, 9 months prior, but not like a long, long time prior. And this is indicating a long time prior. So most people look at this and say, this king who's coming is also God. It's referring to an eternal person who's going to come, and God's going to be the one who takes care of his people, who protects them and defeats their enemies. And there is some shepherd language down there. If you look at verse 4. Well, actually, let's read verse 3 too, just so we get the whole thing. Therefore, he shall give them up until the time when she who is in labor has given birth. Then the rest of his brothers shall return to the people of Israel, And he shall stand and shepherd his flock in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God, and they shall dwell secure for now. He shall be great to the ends of the earth, and he shall be their peace. So it's a fascinating passage because the one coming is from of old, and yet he's coming in the strength of the Lord. And there's some distinction between the one coming and the Lord, and yet the one who's coming is the Lord. So you have this neat little pre-Trinitarian picture of two persons within the Godhead, and this wonderful picture of the shepherd coming from Bethlehem. Now go back, keep your finger there, but go back and look at the way Matthew quotes that, because it looks a little bit different, doesn't it? Matthew says, "And you, O Bethlehem, land of Judah, are by no means the least of the rulers of Judah." Whereas Micah said, "You who are too little to be among the clans of Judah." Matthew changes it. Says, "You are by no means the least among the rulers of Judah." He goes on, as Micah does, "For from you shall come a ruler." But then it looks like he skips down to verse 4 of Micah's prophecy and just adds it there at the end of this quotation. What's Matthew doing? He's playing fast and loose with the Bible? What's he doing here? Well, if you or I did that, I think there'd be a problem because I'm not an apostle and you're not either. And I can't go through and congree the Bible and say, well, I like this. This gives me joy. This does it. Boom, throw it out. But that's not even what Matthew did. Matthew is using Micah. He's interpreting Micah for us. He's giving us, he's quoting Micah, but he's also, as he's quoting it, providing the right interpretation of the prophecy. Yeah, the one who's going to come from Bethlehem is this great shepherd, and that will make Bethlehem, even though Micah said she was the least in Judah, the fact that she's going to be the birthplace of the great king will mean she's by no means the least among the clans of Judah. So he's kind of interpreting that that text for us, and he can do that as an apostle. He can quote texts that way, whereas you and I should be more careful in what we're saying and doing. Questions here about this? Yeah.
This is a question I've been wanting to bring up with you. It feels like in the New Testament, when some of these guys go back and grab a passage, that how would we have seen that unless they either drew that out or changed it?
Great question. You'll notice this if you read through the Bible, especially the New Testament, that sometimes when the New Testament quotes the Old Testament, you think, man, I would never have possibly seen that connection that this was just drawn out yet.
When Jesus was on the road to Emmaus after his resurrection, he unpacked all this stuff for them.
Yeah, I mean, one reason we know that they got the right interpretation of these texts is because all of the apostles were taught by Jesus himself after his resurrection. That's what he was doing with them for 40 days. After his resurrection in Jerusalem, that's what he did in the road to Emmaus with those two. He taught them how to understand the scriptures in the right way. So there's a right. What we have to say, first of all, of course, is that the apostolic interpretation of the Old Testament is the correct interpretation of the Old Testament, and any of our interpretations of the Old Testament that run counter to that are incorrect. So that's the first thing. The second thing we want to say, though, is that what. When we see this all the way through, when the apostles read the Old Testament, they see Christ everywhere. They see the gospel everywhere. And that should also be our key for understanding and reading the Old Testament. You're not just reading stories or hero stories of people in the past. You are reading about Christ in everything that you read. One really fun... Oh, yes, go ahead.
The ESV Study Bible does give the Old Testament references.
Uh-huh.
There
are some, like, she's pointing out that in this quotation by Matthew, he brings together passages from other parts of the Bible to interpret the Micah section. So he's not making that up out of thin air. He's just bringing together some other passages about ruler, shepherd, and putting it as the interpretive gloss of that chapter in Micah. So that's right. Yes?
One good example is when we discover that just Lot was vexed daily with the conversation of the wicked. That's a big surprise
right?
for us.
It is. She's talking about that in the section. I think it is in 2 Peter, is it?
Peter, yeah.
Yeah, where we're told the righteous Lot was troubled in his heart by all the wickedness of of Sodom. But you go back and you read the text, and Lot doesn't look so righteous, nor does he look very troubled. He looks like he's having a great time, in fact. But yeah, the apostles tell us, so you gotta go with that. Maybe they didn't righteous just in the sense that he was credited with righteousness, is probably what they mean. Another place where this happens is where Paul tells us that Hagar represents those who try to achieve God's promises by works, right? Remember God promised Abraham, I'm going to give you a son, and that son is going to bring the blessing to all nations. And Abraham gets old, and Sarah gets old, and Sarah says, hey, why don't you take my handmaid? And so he does, and the child's born. He's the one that Abraham says, hey, I want this, right? This should be my heir. I did it. See, I did all the work. We got this heir. You made the promise. We fulfilled it. And so Paul sees in that a picture of human, fleshly effort to attain the promises of God. He says, no. Hagar is the son of Ishmael is the son of the slave woman, and you're no longer slaves. You're sons of, who's the other one? Is Isaac. Yeah, Isaac. She was born by God's work. He was born by God's work alone. Of course, they had the relations, but God is the one that enabled Sarah to have the baby. And so you have this picture of justification by faith in that story that I would not have seen had I not had the New Testament, and neither would you. So that's a really good point. So let's go back and finish, not finish, but maybe finish, our look at Matthew here. So these wise men, these magi, we don't know how many there are. Could be three, but probably not, probably more. They say the reason the three thing got into our tradition is because they bring three gifts, but there could have been more wise men. We don't know. We're not given a number. So they come to Herod. Herod investigates. He asks the scribes to tell him. The scribes take him to Micah chapter 5. So Herod summons the wise men secretly and ascertains from them what time the star had appeared. Now, this is very important because it's going to inform Herod's choice later on when he decides which children he's going to slaughter and where. Like he knows he's got a rival to the throne. He's hoping these wise men are going to go to Bethlehem and tell him where this guy is. But no worries. If they don't, well, he knows when the star showed up. So, hey, I'll just play it safe. Every kid born under two years of age, I'll just kill him. And that will solve my problem. If I slaughter them all, then I will have certainly got the guy I'm looking for. Kind of a ruthless way of thinking, but that's what he did. So it's important that he ascertain the time. He's trying to figure out all the details he can so he can protect his power. So he sent them to Bethlehem and saying, go and search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. That's really cynical, isn't it? That's very... He at least in appearance-wise wants these magi, these wise men, to think that he's a man of integrity, and surely if the gods bring about the birth of a king, I'm going to go cast my crown down at his feet and worship him like we all should do. He doesn't want to give them any suspicion because they traveled for miles and miles and miles to come and pay homage to the king, and if they sense that Herod's going to wagon, they're going to not want to go back and tell him. So he has to be very careful in the way he asks them to go investigate. Some people wonder why he didn't send an escort with them just to make sure they're safe in the road. People think they would do that. It wouldn't hinge on whether they came back to him or not. But I think when he ascertained the time of the star, it doesn't matter. Right? Because he knows the age of the kid, and he can just kill all the two-year-olds, and that'll solve the problem. So he's not so worried, but he does want them to come back and give them specific information to avoid the trouble. So after listening to the king, they went on their way, and behold, the star they had seen when it rose went before them until it came to rest over the place where the child was. And this is, again, why we would want to say at this point, at least, it's probably not an astronomical event. It is probably some kind of revelatory event. It could be, it could even be some people suggesting that it's an angel. You know, you have an angel, and this is probably, I think, where this, the idea of the angel over the manger, you know, that people have interpreted in the past, anyway, is like as an angel who's guiding in the sky, who's guiding the wise men to the nativity scene. But who knows? It's a light anyway. They interpret it as a star. And it seems like it had disappeared from the sky because it reappears here in verse 10. They saw it. They rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. There it is again. We're on the right track. We're actually coming to our destination. And now verse 11, going into the house. Notice that language again. Going to the house. So now this doesn't necessarily mean that Jesus wasn't born in a stable. We talked about this last time. I think it was a house. This doesn't mean that he wasn't born in a stable. But they are still in Bethlehem. They haven't gone to Nazareth yet. This is probably at least 40 days after the birth of Jesus. He's been presented at the temple more than likely by now. It's around that time. They would have waited in Bethlehem at least until they had him presented. It was a requirement to present your baby in Jerusalem. And Bethlehem's 2 miles from Jerusalem. So they're not going to head up back to Galilee and Nazareth, which is 75 miles away, and then come back down 4 days later. They're going to stay until they get him presented in the temple according to the law. So this is probably around that time. I can't be sure, but around that time, 40 days after his 40 days after his birth. It may be longer, maybe shorter, but regardless, they're still in Bethlehem. And whether he is born in a barn or not, now he's in a house. That's the word that is used for house. Here is clearly a house. It must be, I imagine, still relatives. So you're still staying with people they know here in Bethlehem. And they're taking care of the newborn baby. So they find the house. And they saw the child with Mary and his mother, and they fell down and they worshipped him. The word there is fascinating. You know, there is a way of saying they gave him honor in Greek. There's a specific word you could use to pay homage like you might do for a king. But the word they use here is specifically one you would use for prayer to a god or worship to a god. So these wise men are approaching Jesus as one approaches God himself. An interesting contrast here, isn't there, between the Jews on the one hand, who had the prophetic books, had a little bit of a heads up that, hey, something's going on, and stayed in Jerusalem. And here are these magi who come all the way from their homes, miles and miles away, to not just see, but also to worship the King of Israel. Does that spark any memories, any remembrances of Old Testament stuff in your mind? No? You guys read the Old Testament a little bit, right? There's a lot of stuff in there about the nations of the world coming to give homage to Israel's king and submitting themselves to him and bringing gifts to Yahweh. Nations will come to your light, kings to the brightness of your dawning. This is a lot of prophecy is coming to a head here, and at least foreshadowing the future that God had already foretold through Abraham, that in Jesus all the nations of the world would be blessed, that Abraham would be a blessing to all nations. This is beginning to happen. And it's also coming together a little bit, theme in the Old Testament of the remnant. If you're taking our Isaiah class on Friday mornings, in Israel, in Isaiah's prophecy in particular, there's a theme running through that not all Israel is Israel. You guys have all been circumcised, not you, but Isaiah is talking to Israel. You've all been circumcised, you all do all the stuff, you go to the temple, you pay your tithes, you worship, you do all the stuff. You're part of the visible people of Israel, but not all of you genuinely trust me. Only some of you do. And one day I'm going to draw that remnant of Israel out to myself, and the rest are going to face judgment. We're going to see something today that Jesus thinks of himself as the means by which God calls out the remnant, the believing Jews. He says, those who truly believe and hear from the Father, come to me. And those who don't, don't. So one way you could know which Jews in Jesus' day truly love Yahweh is ask which Jews came to Jesus. Paul, James, John. They all were part of that remnant that Isaiah had prophesied. And here in our text, who's the remnant? Well, we just have Mary and Joseph. No one in Jerusalem has come out with the Magi, but these Magi have come, and their coming, their faith, indicates that they too are going to be joined together with this one body of true Israel. That's another mystery that the Old Testament didn't quite make clear, that's made clear in the New Testament, is that when God promised that he was going to make Israel or Abraham into a great nation, and then also that he was going to bless the nations through Abraham, he was actually promising he was going to bless the nations by making them part of Abraham. There's going to be one people, one shepherd, one flock, one body, one bride, made up of Jew and Gentile, no distinction. And so this is the beginning of that kind of fulfillment of that of those prophetic foreshadows. Questions here? Thoughts? Yeah?
Now they flee Israel.
Yes.
Egypt for their own safety. But aren't they refugees, right?
Aren't they refugees, right? I know that this. You got to be careful here because Egypt is part of the Roman Empire. Okay, so fleeing to Egypt is not like going for over the border to some other country. You're part of Rome.
But they had to.
You're fleeing Herod's jurisdiction. That's true.
Yeah, they had to leave Egypt's jurisdiction.
Yeah. So I just want to be careful with that language because people use it for all kinds of political ways, and we want to be careful about saying that every refugee is like Jesus and those who don't receive all the refugees are like Herod, and just be careful with that kind of thing. That can be the case sometimes, but that's not. Let's be careful with the language, is all I'm saying. And think through things a little more care. Anyway, so let's look at the gifts. They give gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So, if you read through the patristic fathers, the fathers of the church, they spend lots of pages talking about the gifts that the wise men bring to Jesus. What's the significance? If you were to kind of think through symbolically what the significance of these gifts would be, what might they be?
They're valuable.
Very valuable. That's one. Yes. Gold is valuable. It is what you would bring to.
You're a sense for flavor.
Yeah. Now, it's a little bit, I'm glad you brought that up. Bringing gold to Jesus is not like, you know, if you're at an Italian wedding and they give you a ball of cash. This is, gold has inherent beauty and worth, and so it was a fitting kind of gift for a king. It wasn't just like giving your nephew a check for his birthday. It was, it's a great gift. So yes, gold like that. Yes.
Spices were used in burial.
Frankincense. Let's just frankincense and myrrh were used together for a certain purpose, which we'll get to in a minute. But frankincense with other spices was also used to burn incense in the temple, wasn't it?
Oh, no, I'm just seeing the check.
Burn incense that was one of the spices that was necessary to make the kind of incense that you would burn in the tabernacle. And so some people say, okay, well, this is a nice picture for us as of Christ in his priestly role, the foreshadowing anyway, and the gift of Christ being the one who's going to be the mediator between God and man. And so this frankincense is a priestly gift, someone suggests. I don't know if the wise men meant it that way, but that's...
Could the wise men be descendants of Abraham?
Could the wise men be descendants of Abraham? That's a great question, and it's actually possible. It's possible they could be. That ruins the whole Epiphany thing, of course, if they are. But they could possibly be descendants of Abraham because, you know, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not alone when they came to Babylon. The whole bunch of people came to Babylon, and we can assume that there were some who stayed in Babylon rather than coming back during the exile. In fact, we know that there were still communities of Jews there during the Persian Empire, the reign of the Persians. So it may be that these are Jews who are just studying their Bible and coming to one reason that I might suggest possibly not is that these guys are astrologers, and Jews wouldn't necessarily be in the field of magician work if they're faithful anyway. So that's the only objection I might have to that.
Yeah, because Abraham had a stepson, or son, and
Ishmael. Yeah.
He
went to the east, right? And God blessed him, and he had lots of sons. So it could be related to Abraham through Ishmael, or the patriarchs weren't, you know, they weren't. They had lots of kids through other means, and they should have. But so you never know who's related to Abraham and down the line. Yes.
I believe you looked at Isaiah 66 this week, and that might have altered your opinion of the source of the. Of the wise men.
Which I'm not sure what you're referring to. Tell me. Isaiah 66?
Mm-hmm.
Could you read it?
The multitude of camels shall cover thee.
Ah, right. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Keep going.
And the dromedaries of Midian and Ephah, that's Saudi Arabia, all they from Sheba, that's also part of Saudi Arabia, shall come. They shall bring gold and incense, and they shall show forth the praises of the Lord.
Yeah, so there's a sense there that where they came from might not be Babylon, it might be Sheba, some different things. But so we can't be sure about their, you know. I would suggest also that the way Matthew presents this is that foreigners are coming, that non-Jews are coming. So I would suggest that's probably what's going on. I don't want to say that for sure. Yes.
You might have said a phrase that answers this question, but. Is there any way to know whether the gifts that they gave had the same cultural meaning?
What do you mean, in the East and in Jerusalem?
Yeah, as we know, did they give it on accident or on purpose?
I think the gold would have the same meaning, we're giving gold to a king. The myrrh, we'll talk about in a minute, would have the same meaning probably. The frankincense, maybe not, because frankincense would specifically have a meaning for a Jew. They probably, when they gave it, they may not know the significance, but it would definitely point to temple worship and sacrifice. But I don't think that would be known to the East.
And did you also say earlier when you said something about the star? Are you saying? Did you say that the star might not have been a star?
Yes.
The whole time?
It could be the whole time it wasn't. It could be that in the beginning when they saw the constellations they associated with Judah and Israel coming into conjunction with King and said, oh, we got to head over to Jerusalem. And then when they got to Jerusalem and they headed out for Bethlehem, then a supernatural kind of sign. Or it could be they're following supernatural signs all the way.
And are you saying that just because astronomy hasn't confirmed it?
I'm saying that because the movement of the star is unnatural in verse 7, I think it is, where it stops over the place, like a specific home where Mary and Joseph are. And I just don't know of any stars that, or comets or asteroids or whatever.
But the whole way too? So if it wasn't a star, if that means it might not have been the whole time?
Not necessarily, because they could.
I'm saying that it opens that possibility.
It opens that possibility. Because they could have been in Babylon or wherever and looked and saw the conjunction of the stars in the right way, said, oh, we need to go to Jerusalem, that's where the king would be. They head to Jerusalem, they find just Herod, no baby, and then they find out it's in Bethlehem, and then the thing shows up. So it opens up
possibly. That's the case, those wise men could have been the only ones who ever saw it.
For the second sighting, yes, that could have been the case. And it could have also been the case in the first part of it. But more likely that was more. I would argue that the first sighting was probably some astronomical arrangement.
But you're not necessarily saying that that's the that's a belief you strongly have, or that the Bible definitely confirms it. It's just a possibility.
Yeah, we got a lot of theories out there.
Yeah,
so find one that fits with the Bible, and if you like it better than mine, you're welcome to have it. So the last thing they give is myrrh, which is used universally in that era, in that time, for burial spice. And so the Jews didn't inform that they would anoint a dead body with myrrh and wrap it in tightly in clothing. And so we have here in his birth, probably unwittingly on the part of the gift givers, who probably thought they were just getting an expensive gift, which myrrh would be. We have unwittingly here a picture or a pointing forward to his death at his birth. We've seen that before in Luke's gospel. Remember, his mother wraps him in swaddling clothes and laid him down in the manger, and that's language is very similar to what Luke says happens when Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea wrap him in cloth and lay him down in the stone on the stone table in the tomb. All right. Well, we're out of time. We didn't get to genealogies today. We're not going to get to them. We're just going to stop. I would love to get to genealogies, but I think we've had enough of the gospel narratives. No, we've never had enough of the gospel narratives. I think that's the wrong way. we're going to go next week. We'll continue with our systematic theology. We'll finish up the question of the communicable attributes of God and begin. I think what comes next is the doctrine of redemption. So we'll see next week.